Morning, Mr. Harding.
Good morning. My name is Elliot Harding. I'm here on behalf of Michael Parnell. To get straight to the some of the questions that the court previously raised, I'm going to start with the first.
This is Groundhog Day.
I'm going to start with the first point about Judge Carnes had mentioned about the idea that the death information should have been able to come in. Michael Parnell's case is materially different than Stuart Parnell's case in that respect, and that is Kellogg's was my client's only client as a broker between PCA and purchasers, and there were no factual ties to death being related to any Kellogg's products. So from a minute level, a very specific level, the factual aspects or outcomes of the conduct at issue that the judge references, those were not the outcomes of my client's conduct, and that by itself was prejudicial. In fact, Mr. Tolley, trial counsel, referenced that when he moved in motion in limine to suppress or exclude references of deaths and illnesses, he said it's hyper-prejudicial information to my client because it's not associated with his conduct at all.
Yeah, but that's a really good reason to sever your client out for trial. That isn't a great reason to exclude it from the other defendants who very much were, the death very much was the consequence of their criminal actions, right?
I'm not here to argue on behalf of the other ones.
I understand, but I guess the point that the point of the question is, whatever the government may have said and stipulated to, certainly doesn't bind us for a legal determination of whether evidence of death was prejudicial or not. The parties sort of assume that it was prejudicial because the government made this motion and the district court granted it, but that really is not binding on us for whether, for Strickland prejudice purposes, this would be prejudicial or overly prejudicial, such a reasonable jury couldn't have reached a different result, or prejudicial such that no fair trial could be granted, because this evidence otherwise probably should have come in under a 403 analysis.
By no means would it ever have come into Mr. Michael Parnell's case, and by them stipulating it away, it removed my client's ability to sever the case. See, that was referenced in the pretrial
motion. I know, but we're not here on a trial court error of severance. We're not here on ineffective assistance for failing to move for severance. We're here on something very specific, and that is whether you could have gotten a fair trial here with regard to this jury, right?
Absolutely. At the end of the day, I'm just noting the difference as to the judge's point about death being relevant and therefore not prejudicial.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have put us down that rabbit trail, but down there, let me ask you one thing. Yeah, you've heard my questions before. Did you ask for limiting the instruction?
By the stipulation.
Ask the jury be instructed. That they're not to consider anything they may have heard about the result of any of this against your client.
Insofar as the evidence never came in, they never had a reason to.
Yeah, but all the illness stuff came in, and that I guess that goes to Judge Carnes' question, which is, did you ask for an instruction stating any evidence regarding hospitalizations, illnesses, and effects of this is not to be used against Michael because. Michael.
I believe there was a limiting instruction as to the reference to illnesses, I think, but as to the death part, it wouldn't have come up because it was stipulated.
Right.
Well, it would have come up by the end of trial, counsel, if you thought the government mentioned it during trial or it came out during trial.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, thankfully the government never did reference the deaths, and that's why we're here, is because half of the final jury knew about the deaths anyway due to pretrial publicity and community sentiment, and that's the nature of the heart of this matter.
But we've had cases, Supreme Court's had cases, every circuit's had cases, in which there were confessions, and it was wide publicity about confessions. And if the confessions come in at trial, no problem.
You're right, Your Honor, but in Rideau, the confession was played on television beforehand, and that's what ultimately resulted in it being a pretrial publicity issue.
But you can't, it'd be hard-pressed for me to say that this is a Rideau sort of case. I'm having trouble finding that we're there.
I'm not saying it is Rideau. What I'm saying is to judge's point about a confession comes in media coverage and then it comes in during trial, real question is what happens if a confession happens outside in media coverage and doesn't come in trial, and half the jury believes, oh, I saw him confess on TV.
I know, but counsel, if you don't have a Rideau situation, that is the situation where the court has said presumed prejudice comes into play. And because we don't have that here, we don't have a presumed prejudice situation, right?
The presumed prejudice situation isn't limited to a confession being placed.
Of course not, but when the Skilling court looked at it, it looked at to the Rideau factors, some of the same things that were there in that case, and that's the extreme situation they said warrants that kind of instruction. Outside of that, the court in Skilling seems to be very reluctant to give a presumed prejudice.
I think the better distinction is this case from Skilling. Skilling was Houston. I mean, we can go through the factors if.
I'm happy to do that, counsel. But comparing it to something where the court said there wasn't presumed prejudice is less helpful than comparing it to that which they said there is, which is what they did in Skilling. And so, to me, like, let's go through Rideau. So there, the community was compact, and everyone in the community had heard it. Here, Blakely was itself affected. It's 5,000 people in the middle of the area here. But we're talking about an 18-county area here of 300,000 people. 350,000 people. So that seems to be a lot more spread out and not quite as concentrated like you have in Skilling and in Bideau.
Well, the real issue is that it's an 8,000-person jury pool.
Well, sure, but that doesn't tell us where they are. That's a huge swath of area. I happen to live fairly close to that area, and it goes all the way to the Florida border, all the way up to the Columbus area, and sort of the middle of the state. So,
the entire area you've described is heavily reliant on the industry that was materially impacted, not just in this case, but in a very...
Which goes to the merits or lack thereof of a motion to transfer venue. But the question is whether any competent attorney could have looked at that and said, no, we'd rather stay here and try in front of a more... less sympathetic to the government interference in people's crops and manufacturing than we may end up somewhere else. And we know the area. You didn't have three-quarters of a century of experience making the decision like the co-defendant did, but you had a good 40 years?
Well,
40 plus 4, 44 years?
3 points about the idea that it was a conscious decision. First, the stated post hoc reasons as to why they wanted to be in this division versus perhaps Atlanta makes sense. The issue is all those same factors existed within other divisions of the district by which he could have chosen to do, as counsel did in
By who could have chosen to do?
Through a Rule 18 motion, not a Rule 21 motion, counsel could have asked for an intra-district transfer to another division, just as counsel did in United States against Langford.
But if the concept of the strategic decision was that we wanted to be in the peanut community, we thought that would work to our advantage, as you, I think, very capably point out, Albany is the center of that. Macon is not, and Athens is not. I think are the other two options that we're talking about here. Albany is the center of it. I mean, it truly is the peanut capital of Southwest Georgia.
Well, they didn't say they wanted to be a peanut community. They mentioned that they wanted a rural agrarian community in particular.
Who would understand about peanut contamination, right? I mean, that was the point.
Well, the point was the disdain against the government and overreach. I don't think that they stated that they wanted people to talk about peanut contamination specifically.
No, that they would understand, that, counsel, as I understood it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I've read the record to the best of my ability. It seems to me that counsel stated that they wish to have somebody wish to have jurors who would understand that in food production and manufacturing that these sorts of things can happen and there isn't that sort of perfection. Am I wrong on that?
Generally, yes.
Okay.
You're not wrong.
Okay.
Generally, that is how they stated it.
Right.
I do want to get to the point, though. The larger point is that this isn't subject to a strategic decision, and that's our position. And that is because, even in light of Purvis, one, in United States against Langford, the court said that once you've established presumptive prejudice, there's no further duty to establish bias, meaning you don't have to.
Yeah, but that's not a post-conviction case, right?
It's not.
Right, but isn't that all the difference in the world? That's what Purvis is saying.
But Purvis was limited to there's a constitutional avoidance doctrine in that this issue was not before the court in Purvis. And so to sit there and read it as extending into this case and barring the claim that we have before it, I think is...
I don't think it's constitutional avoidance. Now, you may be right that the holding can't cover everything in the world. I don't think you're wrong on that. But still, the concept that Purvis is talking about here, which is that in general, structural errors do not necessarily mean that you lose the Strickland prejudice prong sort of fades away, seems to be pretty consistent with Weaver and with how we've handled lots of other structural errors.
Well, one thing Your Honor mentioned earlier was the few things that are non-waivable.
Right.
One of which is you can't waive the jury. Well, you can't waive an impartial jury. And that's what
you can waive a jury, but you can't do it without I think, a client consent.
Can't also waive an impartial jury without client's consent too. It's the same jury. The idea that you're just waiving a prejudice, the right to a jury at all versus the right to an impartial jury, that's what he's guaranteed by the Constitution.
So anytime there's a potential for a change of venue, you've got to bring the client in a Rule 11 type colloquy with the court about whether the client understands it, whether it's freely and voluntarily made decision, so forth and so on.
That's your argument, right?
I'm saying that there is a hypothetical exception because the certificate that was granted said, is it always the case?
I would say
maybe not, but I'm not arguing that.
We're not going to say question, answer. We're going to decide the issue that question implicates and involves.
I'm just hypothetically an exception. I'm not saying that has to be done at all because I don't think a biased jury should ever be the one finding the outcome of the case as they did in this case. And I'll reserve some other aspects to rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Walker.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Stuart Walker on behalf of the United States. I'm not certain I heard any argument from my friend on the other side that would lead me to change anything I said in the last appeal. I don't stand here to repeat what I said.
Well, I'll try to ask a couple questions about what I think is the one distinguishing factor that your opposing counsel brought up, and that is that he does seem to be, as in terms of prejudice, in a different position with regard to death evidence than the other defendants are. Is that right or wrong, and can you address that for me?
I can address it, and let me do it this way, and I'm glad you asked the question. It gives me an opportunity to argue something that he didn't, but I want to make this perfectly clear for the record. In the reply brief that he filed, he harps on the reception of evidence about deaths in the jury room, you know, post-beginning of the trial. That is an attempt to smuggle in issues that he has twice litigated and lost. That was the...
I tend to agree with you with getting in the evidence of what happened after the jury versus what happened at the time that counsel knew and the information they knew. But if you can focus on me, what evidence came in regarding Michael, and I'm only using the first names because they have this share the same last name, Michael, regarding his involvement in the sickness and ultimately the 9 deaths?
No evidence of deaths came in at all.
What evidence came in regarding his involvement that caused illnesses that we know caused death, but the jury didn't hear?
Your Honor, I'm not certain I know the trial record and the amount of detail that would require. Well, this is what I would point out.
He write that the evidence against him only went to him pushing peanut butter that he knew was... that tests have been altered and things have been done to Kellogg, but didn't and wasn't involved with the deficiencies that went on at the factory in Blakely.
I don't believe that's right. I don't think that's right. And I would point this out. He makes much of the fact about this presumption of jury prejudice, but he was acquitted on 30% of the counts against him. That tells me that the jury is doing its job.
That goes to the Skilling factor. It goes to the fourth and maybe most important of the Skilling factors, right?
Well, I think more than that, even. I think it goes to the point that the jury is sort of sussing out distinctions between the defendants and saying, well, the evidence maybe, you know, ties this defendant to this count for which we think the government met its burden, but we're going to hold the government to its burden on these other counts, and we're going to acquit on the ones we don't think. That is not indicia of a biased jury. So I'm not sure that exactly answers your question, but I think what I'm trying to suggest...
It doesn't answer the question I asked, but it does go to something other than what we're talking about with deficiency. So we've been talking about the strategic decision part of it, but the separate part of deficiency is, would this motion ever have been granted? And that requires an analysis of the skilling factors. And as I understand it, the most important, the Supreme Court has said, not my words, of most import or of import is where a jury acquits on a significant number of counts.
The quote is of prime significance.
Thank you.
That's exactly right. That's what Skilling said.
And he was acquitted of 12 counts.
Yes, 12 of, I think, 45. That goes to the presumption of prejudice, but as Your Honor mentioned, this court's in-bank decision in Campus says, well, the presumption is only the first part. Then we have to look at, is it rebutted? And the trial record, the voir dire evidence here adequately supports the district court's conclusion that any presumption that did arise, it didn't, but if it did, was adequately rebutted by the district court's finding that these jurors that sat in that box and decided this case were fair and impartial. That is subject to what the United States Supreme Court in Patton said is special deference. And there has been no effort to disturb that finding here. And so even if there was a presumption, it was rebutted and has not been overcome. With that, Your Honors, if there are no further questions, then we would just stand on our briefs for any remaining arguments and ask that the court affirm the conviction of Michael Parnell.
Thank you.
One thing I want to note about the four Skilling factors, Skilling was a failure to grant the motion to transfer that was filed. This is a case where it wasn't filed. And so the fourth Skilling factor really isn't appropriate for reverse engineering as to whether or not a motion should or should not have been granted.
But the court was clear, though, that in Skilling that I think I'm going to butcher the quote a little bit, but it would be odd to presume prejudice where a jury comes back with a significant number of acquittals.
Well, the issue in Skilling is would the outcome have been different had a motion to transfer been granted? The issue in this case, as said in Meeks, and Judge Carnes quoted it earlier, is would it have been reasonable to believe that the motion to transfer should have been granted?
That was dicta, counsel.
Well, this is a case of first impression, and I think the court was right to say as much in Meeks, because the idea that I have to then take the next step and prove that the outcome of a trial, that's too many hypotheticals. I mean, to go to a structural error...
That's the whole concept of harmless error. That's the whole concept of Strickland prejudice. It is all a counterfactual. I mean, that is the nature of what we do, is to try to see what would have been if this had happened.
That would be a second layer of a counterfactual that no court has ever said is necessary in an IEC claim for the fact.
I think we implied it in Provenza. I think it might have been dicta there too, but we seem to imply in Provenza that is exactly the question that we have to ask.
The issue here is whether or not he would have, should the motion of transfer have been granted? And it's not a strategic decision because in the record, Mr. Tolley testified he never considered an intra-district transfer. He would have gotten all the benefits of the same things he was generally looking for in Albany to move it to Macon. And under CAMPA and the other decisions from this court, there's every reason to have granted a Rule 18 transfer. As in the Langford case where IEC, where the motion to transfer wasn't reversible error because they moved it from Birmingham to Tuscaloosa, 60 miles. This would have been 100 miles, and it should have been, and that would have just been to Macon. It could have been to Athens in Mr. Tolley's backyard, essentially, if he asked for it. And it's a different standard than Rule 21 presumption of prejudice in the factors as well. He never considered it. So to say it was strategic is wrong, because he admitted that he didn't know that there was a standard difference between Rule 18 and Rule 21 transfers, and he said he never considered it. I don't even think it should have been subject to a strategic decision deference, though, going back to the original point. This is structural. You have a right to an impartial jury. There is no reasonable ground to put it in the worst place to try it in the United States.
So if a juror lies during voir dire,
I'm sorry?
A juror lies, prospective juror, venire member, lies during voir dire, and in fact knows a police officer plays pickleball every other day and just lies about it, gets on the jury. Is that structural error?
It's a showing of actual bias that is actual prejudice, and it's been rendered to be, at least by the Ninth Circuit, and I believe the First Circuit, they've rendered it having actual bias, prejudicial juror on the panel, on the final verdict panel, is a structural error. And I believe that this, what we have, is an entire community that was
even if it. Even if every other juror testifies, listen, she was a holdout for acquittal. We had to practically threaten the woman to get her to vote to convict. And the woman says, I didn't consider it in any way, shape, form, or fashion Officer Billy Bob's deal because he's bragged to me about lying before. I wouldn't believe a word he said. That's structural error?
At that point, Your Honor, I don't believe we're in the world of an IEC claim, and I'm not in a position to really opine on that post hoc review of the matter.
But when you say prejudice doesn't matter, what you're saying is you can have scenarios, extreme scenarios like that, and we're still going to have a retrial, even though everyone knows that it didn't cause the verdict.
In that scenario, I can't speak to it. I can only speak to what we have here. I know my time has run, but our point is a showing of presumptive prejudice is all you have to have. We believe it existed at the time after voir dire, and a motion to transfer should have been made because it should have been granted, and that's the outcome that we need in the case.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Harding. We're going to move to the third case.